some of the music which sealed Lully's reputation as the father of French opera, and the piece which led to his rather unusual death. Composer of the Week with me, Donald MacLeod, is this Monday to Friday at noon on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the drugs expert, Professor David Nutt.
Professor David Nutt is an expert on drugs and how they work on the brain. He trained as a psychiatrist, and for almost 50 years, his research has focused on new drug treatments for anxiety, depression, and addiction. In the late 1980s, he set up the first unit in Britain to bridge the gap between psychiatry and pharmacology in Bristol University. He's now at Imperial College, where he's professor of neuropsychopharmacology. He's published hundreds of scientific papers and 27 books. All of this makes David sound like a pillar of the establishment, but the reason most people probably know his name is that he's repeatedly challenged the government over its policies on illegal drugs and alcohol, arguing, for example, that it's more risky to go horse riding than to take ecstasy. He claims no one in a position of authority dares to speak the truth, but he also stresses, I've repeatedly said, the cannabis is not safe. Well, much to discuss there, David, but before we get into the perhaps more controversial areas of your CV, tell me about the drug of music in your own life. You've got epic tastes. We've got three symphonies, Carl Nielsen, Beethoven, Goretzky. But the music you wanted to begin with is a famous piece by Grieg, Hall of the Mountain King.
Yes, thank you, Michael. Well, the Grieg piece is the very first piece of music I ever remember hearing. And the reason I remember it is because it was my very first day at school. And I was actually terrified of going to school. My mother had to drag me screaming down the road, or at least protesting. And I sat in the class wondering what was going to happen. And then after a couple of hours, we went into the hall to do music and movement, which some of the older listeners will remember. And they played this piece of music. And I was enraptured. It was just a remarkable experience because I'd never danced to music before. But also, we were allowed to dance. We were allowed to stomp around and gradually build up and build up and build up the energy that this music has. And the fact I can remember it since I was five tells you the enormous impact that music can have on the brain and how it can lay down emotional responses, which we've endured now for 65 years. Thank you.
In the Hall of the Mountain King, from the incidental music to Peer Gynt by Grieg, Herbert Blomstedt was conducting the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. And in fact, it takes you, David, to your school experience. You didn't have an easy time there, did you? Or later, when you went on to Bristol Grammar School, because you were quite an anxious child.
Yes, I was always very anxious. I wouldn't sleep away from home till I was 11, and I came from a very much a working-class background, although we chose to be working-class. My father was an avid socialist, so he didn't believe in property. So we lived in a council estate, which was one of the largest in Bristol, and I was never quite part of that community because we listened to classical music and we kind of read newspapers like The Times rather than, I guess, The Mirror at the time. But and then I had to go to this school, which was full of people who'd come up through the prep school. They were more suave and sophisticated and definitely better off than me. Yeah, there was quite a lot of, sort of social anxiety in relation to that move. But the anxiety was there. I remember, it's quite amusing, really, because as an adult psychiatrist, I used to run a sleep clinic here. I've always had terrible sleep, and I guess maybe that's why I know a lot about insomnia. And as a child, I would remember sitting on the stairs, you know, wanting to come down, but not being allowed to come down because I should be in bed. And that was not much fun. But in the summer, it was better than the winter. And the reason it was good in the summer, sitting on the stairs, is because I could listen to the Proms, which my father played every night.
Well, your father, Jack, didn't get the chances you had, and I think you're very aware of that. He had to leave school at 14 to earn money to pay for his younger brother's treatment for polio. How much has that been a motivating force for you in your career?
Well, it had quite a big influence because he clearly was talented enough to go to university. And I became the first person in the family to go to university. So in a way, I was doing it for him as well as for me. And it also was very influential in my decision to work in the NHS. And I spent over 35 years in the NHS. And I've always been very strongly committed to the principle of public health care. And there's no doubt that, you know, the NHS is one of the great social experiments there's ever been. Maybe the greatest social innovation in human history.
You got a scholarship to Cambridge and then went on to train at Guy's Hospital and in Oxford as a psychiatrist. That experience of anxiety as a child, did that inspire the work that you do?
Well, it certainly made me very insightful into the burden of anxiety, and it in many ways underpinned my early research, which was in terms of anxiety disorders and how best to treat them. Personally, understanding the damage that anxiety does was helpful, and I've overcome it largely through cognitive approaches, you know, training myself to be positive and to learn how to give talks and perhaps even how to do interviews like this. But a lot of people can't do that. And yeah. When you see people with severe agoraphobia who won't go out the house and constrain their families for decades because of their fears, you realise anxiety is a very disabling condition. And I wanted to help people with it. And to do that, I wanted to understand what was going on in the brain. Because as unquestionably, anxiety has got something to do with the brain. So I began to pioneer treatments for anxiety that actually are now in use today. I was really one of the very first people to use what we call antidepressants to treat anxiety. I wanted to improve on the benzodiazepines like Valium that were being used. And I discovered that antidepressants over time give a better anxiolytic anti-anxiety effect than benzodiazepines and don't have the problems of withdrawal and dependence.
And presumably, anxiety is a driver for the other area, one of the other areas you've really specialised in, that's to say addiction to alcohol and drugs.
Oh, undoubtedly. If we look at alcohol, probably the most common reason people become alcohol dependent is because they're using alcohol inappropriately to dampen down anxiety and stress. And then they use it repeatedly, they get tolerant to the effects, they use more, and then they become dependent.
And when you were in America, I think you witnessed the awful effects that alcohol can have.
Well, yes, for 2 years I ran the research ward at the National Institute of Health's Alcohol Research Centre. And I interviewed hundreds of people coming through to be detoxified and to be treated. And the reality was, We had very, very poor treatments for them. And on average, becoming an alcohol-dependent person, an alcoholic, will take about 15 years off your life. It's a seriously dangerous illness.
Which makes it rather surprising, David, that you should have chosen Mario Lanza now with a song in praise of drinking.
Yes, well, this is a remarkable song because it sums up why people drink, particularly getting the pleasure. Alcohol is clearly the world's favourite drug, and most people who use alcohol use it because it makes them feel good, helps them engage in social activities. Most people's romantic interactions start with alcohol, as in this song. But it's also really interesting because Mario Lanza, you know, the singer, you know, his life was blighted by alcohol, like so many other people's lives are blighted by alcohol. So there's a sort of double message in this song, that alcohol has a very, very positive effects, but of course it can also destroy people's lives.
Dry beer, lift your stein and drink your beer.
Eins, zwei, drei, vier, lift your stein and drink your beer. Drink, 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 two eyes that are bright as stars when they're shining on me.
Drink, 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 two lips that are red and sweet as the fruit on the tree. Here's a hope that those bright eyes will shine.
Mario Lanza urging us to drink, drink, drink from the second act of Sigmund Romberg's operetta, The Student Prince. We heard the MGM Studio Orchestra in the soundtrack to the 1954 film. I suppose, David, you take completely the opposite opinion that you don't drink at all. Are you a teetotaler?
Absolutely not. Alcohol is my favourite drink. I also have to confess that I'm a part owner of a wine bar with my daughter in Ealing. And that really sums up the complexity of alcohol, doesn't it? It is most people's favourite drug. It's certainly my favourite drug. But it is a drug, and people can get into trouble with it. And a lot of my research in the last 30, 40 years has been trying to work out how we can allow people to enjoy the pleasures of alcohol, but minimise the harms.
You've even patented a liquid that you say has all the good effects of alcohol and few or none of the bad. Just tell me about this.
Well, I've been developing over the last 15 years an alternative to alcohol, which is targeted at producing the positive effects of alcohol, the sociability, the companionship, conviviality, but without all the consequences, such as the liver, heart, brain problems and the hangover. And I've made good progress. We now have some compounds which we are in the process of taking through food safety testing because I'd like to have them available. I'd like people to have a choice when they want to enjoy alcohol. I'd like them to be able to have access to something that is certainly going to be less harmful to them.
And I suppose you road test it yourself frequently.
I have been testing it and I'm pleased with the progress we've made so far.
Now, the next music has a real party feel to it. Oh, well, it certainly does for you because it's the fourth movement from Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. But to you, it is, and to many other people, dance music.
Yes, this reminds me of a remarkable New Year's Eve in 1971. We were at some party on the south coast in Torquay, I think. And come midnight, people were dancing. And I said, well, you might want to think about dancing to this piece of music. Up to that point, it would have been the Rolling Stones and the Who. And I said, this is a remarkable piece of music. This is Wagner said this was the apotheosis of the dance. You know, you can dance to Beethoven. And they looked at me as if I was mad. And I said, no, look, let's put it on. And we put it on. And they danced, and they all danced, and they really enjoyed it because the energy that this piece produces in people is just so profound.
Thank you.
I can just see, David, a group of students almost stamping on the downbeats of the last movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 in A major. Is that what happened?
Absolutely. We were thrashing around. I mean, to say that I dance, of course, is a bit of an insult to people who really dance, but I certainly got plenty of energy and I do throw myself around a lot.
We heard the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by the late and much missed Bernard Haitink, whose career we're currently celebrating here on Radio 3. I said at the beginning, David, that the reason people might know your name is that you were fired rather publicly in 2009. You'd been working as an unpaid government advisor for 9 years, giving advice on drugs policy. And I think the final straw was when you said horse riding was more dangerous than taking ecstasy in terms of fatalities. This might have sounded callous, I suppose, in relation to the tragic deaths at the time of young people like Leo Betts. Looking back, do you think it was naive to say what you did?
Well, it depends what kind of outcome you might have hoped for. I wrote that paper, which was a genuine assessment of comparative harms of horse riding and ecstasy. I wrote it for two reasons. The first was, the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, which I was working on at the time, had been asked to review the harms of ecstasy by the Science and Technology Committee of the Commons. But the government, the Home Office, had said it doesn't matter. Whatever you came up with, we were not going to reclassify ecstasy. It was always going to stay as a Class A drug. And that didn't seem to me very scientific. So I started wondering how we could help government understand comparative harms. Because, I mean, drugs are banned, presumably, because they're harmful. At least they should be banned because they're harmful. And it was becoming clear to me, having spent 9 years working with the Home Office, that actually harm was not the major driver in terms of drug classification. The major drivers were really the media and politics. So I thought, well, what other harms are there in society we can compare with the harms of drugs? And coincidentally, in my clinic, a few months before, I had seen a woman who had suffered severe brain damage falling off a horse. And her personality had changed, and her husband had divorced her, she'd lost her children, she'd lost her job. And I began to wonder how harmful horse riding was, not least because at that time also my two daughters were riding. So I did some research and realised actually horse riding was considerably more dangerous than I had imagined. In fact, I stopped my daughters riding at that point. Then I did this systematic analysis of the harms of horse riding versus the harms of ecstasy and showed that overall horse riding was more harmful, particularly if you jump. So it seemed to me that was an interesting comparison, and I put the paper out when the government was discussing what to do about ecstasy. I thought it would actually reassure them that downgrading ecstasy, which is what we recommended from Class A to Class B, which is where it should be, would actually be sensible and logical because you could say it was less harmful than horse riding. However, what I discovered was that there are a lot of people in Britain and a lot of newspapers in particular that view horse riding as some kind of unimpeachable activity, and I was harangued and assaulted and eventually fired for making that what I thought was a perfectly sensible comparison.
I suppose the problem is that you were presenting pure logic in a sense, whereas what the man in the street and the government were thinking about was the human damage and the misery to families of drug use. And obviously, if you logically analyse it like you did against horse riding or probably even something like skiing or playing rugby, you could come up with that. But people can't accept that when they have been affected by the drug damage that drugs can do.
You say that, but in fact, more people are affected by horse riding. When I used to give talks about this, I would ask if there were any horse riders in the audience, and there'd usually be four or five. I'd ask them, do you know anyone who's died horse riding? And most of them would put their hands up. Hmm. We hide from the world the fact that people die horse riding because we think horse riding is a good thing. We magnify the harms of ecstasy because some people think ecstasy is a bad thing. And the reality is that the drug laws are made based on some kind of moral principle rather than based on comparative harm.
Well, I think I must reassure you by telling you that I limit my relationship to horses to conversation.
Very wise.
What do you think about the way government uses scientists and committees like the one you're on? Do you rather regret the time you spent over those years giving advice?
Well, Michael, I've been asked that question many times. Would I have preferred it otherwise? Well, yes, I would have preferred not to have been sacked. Absolutely. I would have preferred them to have listened to me. But I had to do it. I had to say it. Because if, in the end, if you don't face reality, if you don't, as a scientist, you don't present the evidence as best you can, you lose your role. You lose your integrity. And so I just had to do what I did. And in hindsight, it's probably worked out well, in some ways, not for me necessarily, but it's certainly for the debate up to that point. No other scientist would really go in public and say what I said, obviously because they realised what would happen to them. But afterwards, once I'd done it, the discourse, the debate about drugs and drug harms has become very much more into the public sphere. And most people are kind of interested now in that there is a debate and ask questions about whether the policies really are working.
So, as a psychiatrist treating drug addiction, is there an answer?
Well, there's not one answer. I mean, we have to look at it like a health problem and we have to approach it in the same way, I suppose, as we've approached COVID. We need to look at prevention, primary prevention. We need to work out what the best ways of reducing people's access to harmful drugs and to minimise the harms of the drugs when they do use them. We must not make it worse by criminalising people for using drugs, because that just drives them into a spiral of drug dealing and more drug use. And we need to invent new treatments and develop more effective treatments using modern medicines, modern psychiatry.
We're going to hear music next, which I think you discovered quite recently, and it fits in with a lot of the things that you're discovering about drugs and the brain and the kind of states of being that we might want to get people in. It's the Sinfonia Espansiva by Carl Nielsen, his third symphony.
Yeah, so this is a piece that I've come to love very recently. It's a product of lockdown. I was stuck in my house, which is between Bristol and Bath, and decided, as well as to write books, I would also go through my my CD collection. And I revisited Nielsen and got to really appreciate the subtlety and the quality of his music. And this particular piece is very different from the Beethoven. The Beethoven is about drive and energy and motor activity, dancing. And this is about reflection and thinking and feeling about the bigger picture. And of course, it's called Espansiva because it takes your mind into a state where you can begin to see the horizon and beyond the horizon.
Sakari Oromo conducting the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra in music from the last movement of Carl Nielsen's Symphony No. 3. And for details of all the music chosen by my guest today, David Nutt, go to the Private Passions website. I was fascinated, David, to hear you on Radio 4 a few years ago describing your experiments at Imperial College treating patients with post-traumatic stress disorder. You were giving them psychedelic drugs, and I wonder how that's going. What kind of results are you getting now?
Well, we focus on psychedelic drugs because our research on these drugs, the brain imaging studies we had done, which were the first systematic assessment of the effects of psychedelics on the brain, showed that they might have utility in psychiatric disorders. This is what we call translational medicine. You do some basic science, you ask a question, what does psilocybin magic mushroom juice do in the brain? You image the brain, you discover, to our amazement, it switched off parts of the brain which drive disorders like depression. So then we got money from the Medical Research Council to do a study to see if those brain changes would actually translate into a clinical outcome. And it did. It was the most single psilocybin treatment, producing quite a powerful psychedelic trip, turned out to be the most powerful treatment of resistant depression, depression that has failed to respond to antidepressants, depression that has failed to respond to psychotherapy, that there's ever been. The majority of our patients had a clinically meaningful response after the one dose. And some of them are still well today, a few. In most of the depressions come back. And that raises an interesting challenge as to how we can help them. But the fact is, it was a remarkable finding, and it's now been moved on. We've done a recent study comparing psilocybin with the standard therapy, which is called an SSRI. We used the one called escitalopram. And we showed again that psilocybin had real benefits in terms of speed of onset and in terms of producing greater improvements in well-being and in mood than the traditional drugs. And also, and this has not yet published, but it will be hopefully quite soon, we've shown that psychedelics work in a very different way in the brain. So it's not only that they produce a different effect when you use them, but 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, when you scan the brain, the brain is different. The brain is kind of reset in a more functional pattern following the psychedelic than it has with the current antidepressants.
So is it a bit, this is a very crude analogy, but is it a bit like sort of a defibrillator in the heart, that you get it, you shock it back into a different kind of rhythm?
That's a really interesting analogy, absolutely, yes. I mean, many of our patients don't use that analogy. They use a slightly less challenging one, which is like defragging a hard drive or reformatting a hard drive. It's as if their thought patterns, which were out of control, they were continually ruminating about things which they knew to be ridiculous, but they couldn't stop. It's as if their brain has been reset, yes, very much like a defibrillator.
It's absolutely fascinating, and you've just mentioned that you help patients to come to terms with what they're experiencing, so we ought to stress at this point that if you're feeling depressed, you should not just go out into the field and stuff yourself with magic mushrooms, because you do all this under very controlled scientific conditions, don't you?
Yes, we do this in a hospital, that's right, in Hammersmith Hospital. Yeah.
But are there long-term dangers in taking psychedelic drugs for depression?
Well, we don't think so. And the reason we don't think so is, firstly, that we're only using these drugs once or twice, so it's not as if they're taking them every day. And the other reason we're fairly comfortable is that we've got a lot of historical data. I mean, people don't realise that psilocybin was a medicine in the 1950s and 60s. So we've got data on thousands of people who've been given it, again, intermittently, and shown very little in the way of problems. So I think if it's used in the way we're using it, which is as a specific therapy for a specific condition under medical supervision, the risks are very low. But they're not negligible. They're not non-existent. And one thing we are very cautious of is not giving it to people who have been psychotic or who have a strong family history of psychosis, because we are concerned that it could trip people into psychosis. So we do exclude those from our studies.
And is it addictive?
They're anti-addictive, which is why we're beginning to use them in addictions. And people assume they're addictive because they've been put into this terrible schedule, Schedule 1, Class A, saying very dangerous drugs with no medical value. And people assume, even doctors, even assume that they must be addictive, otherwise they wouldn't be controlled. But they're not. In fact, if you took psilocybin 2 or 3 days in a row, the effect would disappear and you couldn't overcome it by taking more. Hmm.
This all relates to your next music because you play this to patients who are undergoing this kind of treatment. Why?
Yes, so when we do our therapy sessions, when we give people the psilocybin or other psychedelics for their treatment, we don't do talking therapy. People usually put on an eye shade and they have headphones, and we have developed soundtracks that we hope will facilitate them engaging in the experience and maximise the value of the experience. But my next piece of music is something we used in our original soundtrack. It's Goretzky's Third Symphony, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. And this, if there is a piece of music which gets to the emotion, or gets to emotion, particularly the emotion of depression, this has to be it. And I think the fact that it's become such an enormously popular international piece tells us that it really does touch most people, and we find it a lot helps our patients engage with their really deep emotions and hopefully then come out of the treatment with better insights and maybe with their brain defragged.
Music from the third movement of Goretzky's Third Symphony, the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, with David Zinman conducting the London Sinfonietta and the soloist Dawn Upshaw, who's singing the text of a Silesian folk song of a mother searching for her son who's been killed by the Germans. That performance is thought to be the best-selling recording of a contemporary classical music ever, although actually it's a rare choice on Private Passions. What do you think was happening in your brain as you listened to that music, David?
Yeah, that's a great question. This piece must go into wherever in the brain the sense of deep feeling is. Where it is, well, it's probably somewhere in the limbic systems, maybe the amygdala, maybe the insula. And it's not the drive, it's not the activity centre, not the where you get the dance and the energy and the drive, which would be much more the basal ganglia, the dopamine system. This may well be much more the serotonergic system. And it would be really nice to know exactly why it is so powerful in promoting this emotion.
How much is there still left to discover about the brain?
Well, that's a lot, I suspect, because it's the unknown unknown. But I like to describe it to my students. I like to say, I'm not entirely sure we even know the language with which to write the questions about how the brain works.
Have you personally ever been in danger, do you think, of being addicted to anything? And if so, what?
Oh, I'm utterly addicted to my work, absolutely. And my wife complains bitterly all the time, you know, can't you stop? But you know, the reality is I'm 70 now. You know, I nature will stop me soon enough, I think. I've just got a few messages left to get out there and a few things still to discover.
I know family life is very important to you. You've got four children, and this last choice for his Requiem is for them, and particularly for your wife, Diana.
That is correct, yes. So my wife is she sings in choirs. She's sung in choirs in Washington when I worked there and in Bristol and in Bath and in London. And I'm an avid attender at her concerts, and I've learnt a lot of music which I wouldn't have come across if she wasn't singing. And she's sung the Foray very many times. I think it's one of her favourites too. But it's also one of my father's favourites. And my father was the person who really introduced me to music, to the Proms and to Requiems. I used to really like the Verdi because it was driving and phenomenally strong and energetic and sort of cataclysmic. But getting to like the Foray more and more is a reflection of the fact that I'm slowly maturing from being a kind of belligerent, testosterone-filled adolescent to being a possibly a slightly more wise and reflectful old man.
Well, we'll help you on your journey to paradise with the In Paradisum from Foray's Requiem. David Nutt, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. It's been an absolute delight.
In Paradisum from Fauré's Requiem, with Harry Christophers conducting the 16 and the Academy of St Martin in the Fields. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, David Nutt. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke, and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And as ever, you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds, where you can also download hundreds of previous editions. And the programme returns next Sunday at noon, when Michael Barclay will be in conversation with the businesswoman Dame Stephanie Shirley. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news, read by me, Danielle Jawowiecka. The Education Secretary, Nadim Zahawi, has backed cutting the COVID self-isolation period from 7 to 5 days in England. Speaking on the Sunday morning programme on BBC One, Nadim Zahawi said the change, if deemed safe by health officials, would ease staff shortages in important sectors such as the health service, schools, transport and supermarkets. He rejected newspaper reports that the government was considering axing free lateral flow tests. The boss of one of London's busiest hospitals has said he's worried about losing staff when new rules come in requiring them to be vaccinated. From April, frontline NHS staff in England will need to have had 2 COVID jabs or they'll be moved to another role. The chief executive of King's College Hospital, Clive Kay, who is encouraging the take-up, said 10% of his staff of 14,000 were still unvaccinated. Rail passengers are facing more travel disruption because some train companies are unable to operate full services due to rising COVID cases among staff. Great Western Railway has introduced a temporary timetable, which includes further planned cancellations. The operator says updates will be made weekly until the impact of the Omicron variant has lessened. The Shadow Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has claimed that a plan by Labour to ease the burden of soaring energy prices would save families an average of £200 on their bills. The party has suggested removing VAT from bills for a year and charging a windfall tax on North Sea oil and gas companies. The government says it's already given more than £4 billion of support to vulnerable households. Russia's state news agency says at least 164 people are now known to have died during almost a week of violence in Kazakhstan. More than 5,000 people have been arrested as part of investigations into the unrest, which began when demonstrators took to the streets angry about the cost of fuel. And part of a cliff has collapsed onto leisure boats onto a lake in Brazil, killing at least 7 people. 32 others have been injured and another 3 are missing. A rescue operation's underway. Local fire officials say days of heavy rain may have contributed to the incident. Now the weather, and rain will continue to affect parts of southern Scotland and northern England during the afternoon. Elsewhere will be mainly dry with sunshine and a milder night ahead. That's the BBC News and weather at 1:02.
For an inspiring selection of music with no distractions, you can always turn to the Intune mixtape. The Intune mixtape